Hello and welcome to the Psychomedia podcast. I am Timothy Swan.
And I'm your Venus. I'm your fire and your desire. And together we're going to be discussing the funny side of psychology.
Ah, Ben, very much the Venus Calipigios of my heart. Man.
Didn't know she was day. Greek. Or a pigeon.
Venus Calipigios actually means Venus of the beautiful buttocks and is like a famous sculpture and or like a subcult of Venus. Like, have I not talked about this before?
Oddly, no.
Well, it's because it's quite hard to have Calipigian as one of your favourite words.
I know what Calipigian means.
Yeah.
I'd heard that before.
Because it's such a great word and it's so specific, but it's very hard to use it when you're not kind of in a way that is non-objectifying. So you have to talk about the statue and that's it.
I've
I'm not allowed to describe any woman as good looking, especially not in that way.
Anyway, hello and welcome to the show. This week we're going to be talking about spooky things because it's Halloween.
Yeah. Anyone going to challenge us? Exactly.
I thought not.
It would be pretty cool if there was some way that someone could challenge us. I suppose if there was someone else in the house.
There is not.
Exactly. But I suppose if you did want to challenge us, you could do it sometime later in the form of feedback.
Please do. Speaking of, Tim, I've got some back feeding this week.
Okay.
I genuinely do.
So, okay, I've got some as well, you know.
Randall was kind enough to review us on his blog, uncannyrandall.wordpress.com. And gave us a very, very pleasant and nice review. So thank you for that, Randall.
Basically, any lines just like, jump out at you, Ben?
What makes the show stand out, though, is that the hosts actually do real research. That's a generous way of putting it, but I appreciate that. And that Psychomedia is pretty much solely to blame for my move from disdain for the science of psychology to fascination with it, which, you know...
Yeah.
Changing hearts, changing minds, one study about scrub jays or overuse of porn music at a time.
Oh, do you have the scrub jay like sound on your soundboard?
I've got
okay.
I've got the Genie Jay. I'm not sure if I've got any others.
The Genie Jay which grants you wishes. But only wishes that relate to pine nuts.
And killing squirrels. So thank you very much for that, Randall. That was very nice of you to review us.
I used to like message everyone who liked us on our Facebook fan page, and I kind of stopped because the likes became increasingly implausible in distant and non-English speaking countries. But one of the last ones that I, on that borderline, I messaged was someone called Serena. I said, look, just like, how did you come across the show was kind of my key question, because I'm always interested. And this Serena helped me and said, hello, I found it via internet, and it's very interesting. So thanks, Serena, for your compliment and to the show. But... like, a little lack of detail. You know, it's hard to find a podcast without the internet. We have discussed that before.
Sometimes I will grant, sometimes you do come across them down the bottom of the garden, but usually they're not very good ones, you know. We found out, like, a couple of old episodes of The Bugle kicking around in, under the shed one year and had to sort of chase them out. But the
they
slugs
were the ones
got them.
Like John Oliver in a hotel room, which no one likes. I say no one likes. They're still fine. They've got more Andy, so in my mind. Anyway, isn't it Douglas Adams who said, can't we just appreciate that a garden is beautiful without having to have podcasts at the bottom of it?
Yeah, so that was cool. Yeah. We also got some feedback on the WordPress page from Charles. He writes, you mistook the APA for the APA. The APA that publishes the format guide is the American Psychological Association. The APA that publishes the DSM is the American Psychiatric Association. So don't say that the APA publishes the DSM when it was the APA, not the APA, that published the DSM. Thanks, Charles. Well done.
Yeah, you see, I was getting confused with the American Psychoanalytic Association and the American Psychopathological Association. The latter, sadly, is not an association of psychopaths, unlike the American Psychiatric Association. Burn! actually, it turns out, like, the other P's that you can slot into the American P Association are plywood,
pangolin,
polygraph, philological, philosophical, and poultry. So, hey, like,
hey, don't forget pangolins. Pangolins. That's literally the only word beginning with P that I came up with.
Yeah, but all of mine are real, whereas pangolins are definitely mythical. Because I can't handle that that's a thing that exists. They're kind of so cool, but I still can't get over that they're real. Also from Charles, let's not say that I'm stalking. Let's just say that Google is sometimes something you can use for self-indulgence.
Google is doing stalking for you.
I am chaste and pure. My self-indulgence via Google is to search for the show. And Charles commenting on somewhere, describing us as... a UK-based podcast hosted by a pair of college friends, one of whom is working in mental health, while the other pursues a doctorate in social psych. I think, I know that's what people use, but I got this real picture from that statement of you just, like, running after this, like, doctoral paper on a bit of, like, a fishing hook that your, like, supervisor was running around the streets of Oxford with.
Yeah, it's, I have to say, my doctorate at this point is pretty elusive. It's far into the distance and accelerating at this point, and I am caught in a hedge somewhere. The horse upon which I am pursuing my doctorate is refusing every single fence, or at least that's the way it feels right now.
We also had some feedback from Sam saying, after Robert Mugabe, Jacob Zuma is my go-to African dictator now that Leopold II is out of the game. Also controversial, but I pointed out that your go-to expanded universe character, apart from, of course, the droid G-O-T-O, which is named after the go-to command. Sam replied, it would probably be less Mitrasuric than Mithral Nerudu. And then I pointed out I was obsessed with Mara Jade as a child. And so all of, like, the games with the infinite number of Star Wars figures we had pitched me against my little brother, all kind of spinning off from playing the Dark Forces 2 of... So I was Rebel Leader Tim Jade, and he was Dark Emperor James Skywalker. And then I read Vision of the Future, and it's like, whoa, Jades and Skywalkers are, like, related. Proper Empire Strikes Back moment that happened really spontaneously. Anyway, because Star Wars occupies the majority of my brain every week.
It has also been doing it this week.
What has newly occupied the majority of your brain this week?
Well, actually, something which has been occupying the vast majority of my brain this week has been Star Wars.
What a coincidence.
Literally watched all of the original trilogy.
I need to do that.
And it wasn't my idea. Christina just, like, voice pipes up from the sofa behind me, hey, we should totally watch Star Wars. And, you know, it's that point in a young nerd's life that he kind of thanks the great green arcle seizure that, you know, fate has deigned to put such a vision of loveliness on his sofa, who is asking him to watch Star Wars. It was pretty, yeah. It was a pretty great moment. Yeah, no, it went well. She was a big fan of R2-D2 and the Ewoks, which is fine. And yeah, had lots of...
Well, actually, not like... So
she'd seen, like, bits of the first one... but she hadn't seen Empire at all, so that was good. Her favourite was Jedi, which I think is, you know, that's
well, Jedi is my favourite.
Okay, so okay.
Before judging, like, her on the show, like, think about
I wasn't going to. Yeah. As far as I know, it's like it's a rough split between Empire and Jedi. So, yeah, I thought it was really interesting.
See,
I like sort of going back to these things that I haven't seen in a long time because. You know, I was finding it interesting to try and work out what aspects of it, of them, that I really, really like. And apart from anything else, the thing that just struck me was how enraging it is, all the, what was it, the director's cut or the, special edition
okay.
crap that George Lucas put in, like the CG Jabber and all that rubbish. Because it really detracts.
I can't disentangle my, like, childhood feelings from that. Because I watched the video special editions over and over again. So in my head, that is Star Wars. Like, there is a CG Jabba, and there is the proper music for the Ewok celebration. Not the original one, but the victory celebration, which is much better. But they don't go to Naboo at the end. And Sebastian Shaw is Darth Vader, not Hayden Christensen. And So I do like that. I do really like the special editions, but it's probably because I literally watched them on a loop as a kid.
I guess it's just the thing that struck me about it was like those films. There's a lot wrong with them, like it from a purely objective like film critic standpoint. But
yes,
there is an awful lot that is very interesting about them, and that I like to watch them kind of like you would watch any classic movie. You know, it's there are flaws, obviously, and they are dated in a lot of ways. But then there is also some really cool stuff about them. And you can appreciate that cool stuff all the more by kind of framing them in the time that they came out. And having all those like post hoc crappy CG injected into it kind of ruins the ability to view them as like classic films.
OK,
I would prefer to see them kind of warts and all in their original state. But, you know, it's a personal preference.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes total sense to me.
And the other thing that's been occupying the vast majority of my brain this week has been World War II. Like, weird. It's one of these.
Did you watch The Trench Run and think, I seem to remember this might be ripping something off?
Well, yeah, I mean, that arguably is point one on the list, but like just one of these weird confluences of related media this week. So we started watching Foyle's War.
Okay. Which,
have you come across that?
I've heard of it, but I get confused between that and the Foresight Saga, which I know are two very different things, but it's one of those like slightly dyslexic associations that goes in my head.
So
is he a spy in the...
No, he's a police detective.
Okay.
Michael Kitchen plays a police detective set in England during the breakout of World War II. And it's kind of procedural police investigation, drama, mystery type stuff set against the backdrop of World War II. So, you know, like when one episode, like a conscientious objector has been murdered and it's, you know, all this kind of thing. But they're like hour and a half episodes. So it's like it's very Agatha Christie in kind of the way that the mystery is done and, you know, the setup and all the different possible people who could have done it and all that kind of thing. And it's just really, really good. Like I could not recommend it more highly. There's about 8 seasons worth of it with 4 episodes each. All the cast are fantastic. He has a driver, a female driver played by an actress whose name, I kid you not, is Honeysuckle Weeks.
Okay.
And their chemistry is fantastic.
So is this the new version of Foyle's War then?
Well, I wasn't aware that there was a previous version. This has been going since 2002.
Okay. I thought there was like a 70s one or something.
Maybe. I don't know. But yes, we've been watching the 2002 one.
Honeysuckle Weeks was in like a children's TV show I watched as a child, and I always thought it was amazing to have someone for Honeysuckle. Can I just highlight a couple of things?
Please
one,
do.
There's an amazing thread online, which I'll have to find a link in the show notes, about how World War II is the most unbelievable TV show ever, talking about how essentially history is more unbelievable than fiction, and like how did the Nazis not win when they managed to successfully make the jet plane first and all that sort of stuff, and like in season 4 they killed off the Nazis and they still had the Japanese as bad guys, and that's kind of terrible writing, you've got to wrap this up, and these sort of things. It's so funny, but it also tells you a lot of interesting stuff about the war. Also,
put it in the
I have
show
done a lot of lovely things these last couple of weeks, but I'm pretty sure the only thing that the listeners want to hear me talking about is playing Dark Forces. And I just want to say one thing. So, like, hold the alarm. Kyle Katarn, even in this something of a Doom ripoff, he walks into a mining facility, plants a, like, charge, throws a thermal detonator in the face of a Terminator-like droid, and then walks out as the whole place explodes. There is a reason he is the Chuck Norris of Star Wars. And it is because he just, like, he is one of those sort of action heroes who walks away from explosions and does not look back. That is relevant to the studies.
Yeah. Okay. I suppose I have to hit the bleep now. The thing is, that now just seems silly because I said that World War II is occupying the majority of my brain. There were like 3 other World War II related things that I've been up to this week, but you know.
Okay, no, quickly.
The bleep says.
Anyway, let's talk about Finland.
Yeah.
The country that somehow combines the desolate wastes that hosted the Winter War with the wife of the head of Rovio who wore an Angry Birds dress to the Finnish palace. maybe I just spent longer on Wikipedia in that prep than I ought to have done. But a lot of European countries have super interesting histories that we know very little about. You know, I studied the Soviet Union in GCSE. And that included the Russian Civil War, but it was basically the Bolsheviks fought everyone else, and then there were some foreign interests, and then the Bolsheviks won. So that's the Civil War done. Let's move on to the death of Lenin. On the
subject, I got stuck on the Wikipedia page. It will become apparent later on in the show why, for Vlad Tepes and the Vlachul dynasty. Wallachia is an interesting old province right there.
Yeah. I find Vlad the Impaler infinitely more scary than any real vampire. And there's a Hungarian serial killer woman, and she tortured to death about 300 people and got away with it because she was a noble woman. And that's
Elizabeth Bathory.
I think it is, yeah.
Because she's the other one that I mentioned in this show.
Okay,
yeah.
Right, good. Well, that's definitely going in the show notes there. But seriously, that stuff and those things scare me a lot more than monsters and that sort of thing.
Did you know that the national animal... Can you guess what the national animal of Finland is?
Is it a bear holding a sniper rifle?
It is a brown bear. This is the best country! They have the best music, the best national animal.
I mean, it is worth reading about Finland, the Finnish Civil War and this weird, split between, the pro-Russians and the pro-Germans. And it's and what they had then was this thing called the Compromise, where they're we don't, the Civil War has been inconclusive. We're not joining Germany or Russia because Germany and Russia have both lost the war now. I guess we'll be Finland. So, let's get over the fact we, killed thousands of each other's sides and just kind of be Finland now. It's really weird. Anyway, so we're in Finland for their advanced technology to join Ekman, not that one, and Kaistia, yeah, that one. and they want to find out what sounds in games are the most emotionally affecting. I was going to joke that it's game over, but actually it turns out that's true. I may have spoken on the podcast before. Actually, another sound in another game of the Dark Forces series, Mistress of the Sith, which I have also got on Steam now, thanks to my brother, with its incredible spooky sounds on the Sith world of Dromund Kaas, haunted spirits and so forth, which something with my TV simulated surround sound. I'm half looking forward to it. I'm half dreading it because it creeped me out so much as a child. It better not be disappointing. I mean, there's a very good reason I'm not ever going back to the Crystal Leisure Centre in Stourbridge, and that is the fear of the memories of something epic being undone by contemporary reality. I'm sure you have. Do you not have those fears? I can't rewatch that show. 90s X-Men. I heard someone say, actually, if you revisit, it's terrible. So I was like, oh, I was going to watch that on Netflix after watching Days of Future Past.
I have it more if it's... I've extolled the virtues of something from my childhood to someone and then they watch it and they don't like it. Because I can usually reconcile myself to those things and appreciate the elements of it that are genuinely good and kind of laugh at the bits that aren't. But if I've told someone that it's awesome and then you watch it and it's crushingly bad, that's an issue.
Okay. But we agree that Aquila is still amazing, right? but Star Wars, someone did ask me, why do you like Star Wars so much? And not just that, why do people like Star Wars so much? And I said, I guess a prelude to that whole How I Met Your Mother business, I said, well, it kind of encapsulates the hero's journey. George Lucas took the hero's journey, turned it into a film that made it in its most pure form, and then set it in an awesome setting. And so that's why people resonate with it, because it is the kind of archetypal story. But it doesn't try and be clever with that. It just makes it the absolute archetypal story.
Mm.
And then also it's the stuff about when exactly you watched it. But obviously there is a vulnerability for me being you should watch this Star Wars thing, or you should, obviously I say lesser to people, you should read this Star Wars thing because it's much better than, the prequel trilogy or something. And you do feel vulnerable about doing that sort of thing. But no, I also have this, I can't go back to X thing that was amazing in my childhood in case it turns out it's disappointing through the eyes of an adult.
That's
anyway, Ekman and Kaistia, quesadilla?
Quesadilla?
I don't speak... Well, like, what would a Finnish quesadilla be like? Like, is there a Finnish, like, traditional cheese? They want to find... excuse me, I'm getting all choked up talking about the things I love from my childhood. They want to find ways to make scarier sounds for video games. Well, everyone needs a hobby. You know, I actually picture one of them on a first date. So what do you do for fun, he asks, and she says, because I'm heteronormative and I'm sorry. Oh, the usual music, the cinema, hunting with sniper rifles. It's Finland. Sorry, I'm not just heteronormative, I'm stereotypical. Put me on a BBC panel show already. And what about you? And he replies, oh, you know, try and use sound localization techniques to increase fear responses. Now, of course, this is rather fanciful. People don't tend to do these things for fun.
Which he follows up with...
It will be more of a like predator noises. We'll get to that. The issue is that we know that sounds of all sorts are emotive. But it's easier in films. You write a scene, you know the emotion, you get the composer to write that emotion. I think because I listen to music for its emotional qualities above all others, that's why I do love soundtracks. Tron Legacy, Inception, Star Wars. In a game, the action isn't following rails. It's dynamic. I mean, how can you get emotional quality into that, Ekman and Kai Stiller ask. For the one thing I've said, the action isn't fixed. But actually, the research they reviewed showed that emotional reactions in games are less from story, anyway, than from success and failure of user actions. And I know that I didn't so much cry at the dramatic death in Final Fantasy VII as I did all those times I didn't get a good result on Kate Sith's Limit Break. That might be one of the nerdiest jokes I've ever done on this show.
That, I mean, it's the idea up that there, I would... but it's up there with a lot of others.
Yeah, the Hall of Fame is rather crammed. Mm. The idea that anyone would use Kate Sith's Limit Break, I mean, really. And therefore, emotion in sound design actually follows contradictory strategies to film, they say. So, how does game sound design currently work? What you start with, at least as of 2009, when the study was written, is that there's a set of predetermined samples that are triggered, mixed, and manipulated on the basis of game parameters. Time of day, player location and movement, and gameplay variables like signaling threat. You know, things like nuclear launch detected. And sometimes they're less straightforward than that. Obviously, a threat-related sound, we would expect to have certain sonic qualities that are categorically, you know, they are naturalistically associated with that emotion. They suggest a thunderclap for fear or laughter for happiness. But when it comes to, say, music or just less natural sounds, the boundaries aren't categorical. It's about discordance, volume, tempo, suddenness. And if you take those naturalistic sounds, they believe a way can be found that doesn't make thunder happy, but it does control its scariness. Now, this is going to be a different process, they believe, to the techniques used in music. Thunder in C isn't less scary than thunder in F sharp minor. Disclaimer, I haven't tested this. There are some kinks in my weather control project, so can't really do the psychological testing I want to do until that's all worked out. sorry, just thought of something else. So, they turn to emotion theory. Obviously, this means that they look at mad scientist and proponent of VITI, Bob Science, formerly living incarnation of science. The point that he made that stands up to any measure of sanity, the only point that he made that stands up to any measure of sanity, I might add, actually probably only applies in terms of fear, that emotional reactions can be precognitive, not the kind of precognitive you're thinking of, as in they occur before thought, not thought that precedes reality. And further research has shown that even only subconsciously received stimuli can trigger fear. Now, if you really want to test this for yourself, watch Event Horizon. And if you ever want to sleep again, don't do that.
This relates to stuff, I'm sure we've discussed it on the podcast before, about infrasound, like sound waves beyond the level of conscious hearing, which evoke like crippling fear. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, no, I have heard of this. You know, it's like, my kind of like, you know, if it's numbers stations or like sonic manipulations of people. I love the conspiracy theory stuff without believing any of it.
Well, it's used as a potential explanation for a lot of like haunted house phenomena, because they have found that a lot of
resonance,
like rooms in houses that are supposed to be haunted, are like the confluence of a number of resonant outputs from local factories. But the one
so
key
David
example
Lynch
of it
was right in using industrial sound to scare us.
Quite well, almost certainly. But like the one example that they use of this is like if you ever hear a tiger's roar live, then something about it literally just does plug into your hindbrain and just turn on your like fear response.
okay. I mean, that's very adaptive.
Mm.
It's useful we still got that saved somewhere. The evolutionary adapted emotional response to sounds is mentioned in this paper. They think things like cute sounds are evolutionary adapted emotional responses. They don't describe what they are. A lot of cute things don't make cute sounds. Like me and... but like babies. Babies can make lots of disgusting sounds while still being cute. I'm sure you could think of a cute sound and then attach it to like a non-cute thing, like a piano or a synthesizer.
On the subject of sounds and evolutionary adaptations and babies, I was around at my friend's house who has a new baby, and the baby had been put to bed, and we were playing Lords of Waterdeep outside. And we got a little loud at times, forgetting that there was a baby, but he didn't wake up, thankfully. Then my friend left a packet of garlic bread in the wrapper on a hob, and it melted and produced acrid smoke, which set off the fire alarm, which also set off the fire alarm in the room that the baby was in. And he slept through it. And
wow.
The fact that he slept through it was amazing, but afterwards, my friend sat down and was like, I sometimes worry about the future of a species that is adapted to such an extent that their offspring do not wake up when that happens.
yeah, that's true. But basically, all I now just want is those genes as injectable. Just, you know, for like the potential in 20 years' time to have a child or something. Just like, okay, my sleep genes are terrible. You know, they came down from my father whose sleep genes are terrible. I need to borrow someone who can sleep well, and always has since they were a baby, and just like inject that. That's the one genetic manipulation I would do. No others.
Yeah, I'll hold that to you in 20 years' time.
I think if you made a list of all the things that I said might happen in the future if I had kids, like, don't. It will be bad for them, and it'll be bad for
please,
me.
Please don't do that.
Regarding evolution, they believe a sound will be scary the less easy it is for the brain to figure out where it's coming from. This idea of unseen threat would trigger more fear than something we could turn and then fight or run from. Similarly, if you impair the ability of someone to localize sound, their fear should go up in general. And finally, if you cut off someone's ears, you better hope that you're playing Steeler's Wheel, because crimes are okay if they reference pop culture.
Sure.
That's my defense, Your Honor. They tested 8 participants. Like, I guess trying to get away with Tarantino crimes. Like, most crimes reference Tarantino, kind of, by definition.
This is true.
They tested 8 participants, 6 male and 2 female, and played 4 different sounds, which were all based on predator noises. I mean, other stimuli that they could play to gamers to invoke fear. I mean, there's the obvious sound of being in multiplayer with a 13-year-old with a headset. Literally any comment featuring the alliterative phrase, girl gamer. They had them in a room with 3 speakers in front, 3 to the right, 3 to the left, and 3 behind. And they played the sounds, either playing to them from 3 speakers at the same time, or from 1 speaker, and each time in the general direction of one of the corners of the room. Obviously, they did lots of balancing of where the stimuli would come from so that all the participants heard an equal amount of sound from all directions. And because the general direction would still be really obvious, they also played a background sound that was of nature ambience, not to be confused with mature ambience, which is just the sound of adults thinking moderately deeply about mortgages and pension plans, and not whatever you were thinking about. They would play 2 of the sounds and have the participants rate which was scarier in a forced choice, as well as answering questionnaire questions about their interpretations of the sound.
I'm sure I've made this joke before, but forced choice is one of the least useful powers from Dark Forces.
I love that. Like, that's the thing about Dark Forces that really wasn't really there in Star Wars itself. Was all force powers, it's just anything with force in front of it. So then it did lend itself in those childhood games to making up additional force powers. The most ludicrous being Force Deadly Ship. A ship appears and crashes through the force somehow. And my brother would correct me that it's not actually a force power. It was just called Force Deadly Ship, but I forget why. Like, we were 8, 6, and 4 when this came up with, so, you know, kids logic. Like, why couldn't we have written Axe Cop? So the participants could play and replay the sounds at will, and they had them in quite a dark room, lit only by a lamp and the computer monitor. You know, much like so many of us play horror games. Actually, you know, I own Amnesia, and I still haven't installed it. But when I do, nope. I'm not going to play it in the dark.
Nope. Going to play it in the light with no headphones on, surrounded by my friends with happy music playing.
Alternatively, I'm never going to install it.
Yeah.
So
more likely.
They found that sounds that come from behind are more scary than those from in front from a single point, and sounds that come from behind are more scary when they're spread out than when they're not. So basically, these two factors either add up or cancel each other out. That is to say, a front spread is about as scary as a back point, as the actress said to the bishop. Right, so the reason I've started saying, as the actress said to the bishop, is because the first recorded use of That's What She Said, according to Wikipedia, is from an incredibly racist musical song from the 1890s called All Racial Slurs Look Alike to Me.
Right, yeah.
So given that's like the first recorded origin of That's What She Said, I'm going for As the Actress Said to the Bishop a bit more.
Yeah, there's something vaguely carry-on-esque about As the Actress Said to the Bishop that appeals to me.
Yeah, exactly. So, you can gradually change scariness without changing realism just by making the sounds a bit more diffuse. And this obviously goes along with the naturally scary sounds. It isn't going to have that effect on just any sound. I'd like to actually repeat this with, like, baby's laughter or some other happy stimulus, because although a predatory growl...
I was going to get it in somewhere!
I suppose so.
Talking about video game sounds.
There was going to be something 8-bit in there. I don't have, like, any video game sounds. I didn't have a Nintendo as a kid. I was a Sony kid, so... Well, I say I didn't have a Nintendo. I had a Game Boy Advance. And then I had, like, before that, like, I've been a PC gamer. Like, that's where I began. Like, an Amstrad 1640, like, with a, like, DOS-based game called Drop, in which you fly a helicopter, like, from 1988 or something. Like, PC gamer from the very beginning. anyway, so a predatory growl, it's always going to be spooky. Some normally jolly stimuli can be modified into something creepy. I don't know, the Benny Hill theme or something like that. So they believe that despite having only covered fear as an emotion, this is worthwhile because fear is pretty much the key emotion in most video games, even if the tone of that fear ranges from a sort of alert alarm through to total terror in different genres, that we can now create more emotionally responsive or tunable games. If only they could do the same for gamers.
Having some more tunable gamers would definitely be a good thing.
you hit them with a fork, and then the fork resonates, and then you hit them with the fork again for good measure.
Yeah.
So that's like spooky sounds, Ben.
Spooky sounds. Spooky sounds. Well, my study isn't particularly about spookiness, but the only belaboured segue that I could come up with is that study was in set in Finland, was it?
It was done by Finnish people?
It was done in Finland.
You know, like, studies tend to be factual and thus not be set anywhere.
Okay. Well, it was done in Finland. Finland is the home of amazing heavy metal, and this study in my notes I have titled Mouse Blood, with a V instead of a double O in the blood. It's pretty metal, all things considered. So as I'm sure you're all aware, many Western countries, including the UK, are currently experiencing an aging population. You know, as healthcare provision improves and birth rates decrease, the average age of the population increases and skews progressively older and older, and this presents a number of problems. You know, economic strain on the active workforce, pressure on primary care provision, a shifting political consensus towards moral conservatism, xenophobia, and general opposition to things that are either new or loud, and of course, the devastating impact on the mental well-being of 13 to 18-year-olds who are increasingly forced to try and explain how to do the emails for the 100th time to their aging relatives. It's getting that it's feeling like a very kind of middle of the road stand-up gig. That little section right there.
Come on, that's the road to success. That's the road to the Comedy Roadshow, Ben.
Right, moving on. So, in psychological terms, the aging population presents a particular problem in that an ever-increasing proportion of the population are experiencing age-related degenerative disorders like, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's. This problem has actually, you know, it's even reached the attention of politicians with, in 2012, David Cameron launching the Dementia Challenge, which is a wide-ranging program of medical and social interventions which are targeted solely at improving the well-being of the elderly and their carers, and not in any way motivated by the potentially vast and growing voting bloc that they represent. Just whizzing through onto political satire now. I wrote this yesterday. Jeez.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I feel like we're developing in our lives day by day, Ben, and you finally become the one who does the satire.
Yeah. It was
like,
it was going to get
a switch now.
It was, I mean, it's going to get, it was going to get a lot more satirical than this. In my what move, I was going to say that the padlock on my shed was really wet this week, and for that reason, I voted UKIP, because it has the same level of connection to, like, you know, the economic downturn as the presence of immigrants or something like that.
Okay, wow, that's like that's a really elaborate bit of satire. Like, I'm impressed. I assume I was quite happy. Like, European elections, the only time that I vote for someone and then that person gets in, it's almost as if proportional representation is the only way to get good representation. voting Green, I've done it twice. They've got a candidate each time I voted. My vote is the magic silver bullet.
Yeah, I felt quite...
Oh, we're talking about vampires, weren't we? Not.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Also, I appreciate that thus far this study hasn't been particularly scary. Don't worry. It'll get there. So...
I don't know. I think a looming aging population is more terrifying than...
It's kind of existentially terrifying, whereas what we're going to talk about now is just straight up gross and disgusting. Anyway, so aging population, a problem, degenerative psychological disorders, strain on healthcare, etc. However, a new study published in Nature Medicine may provide an effective and cheap alternative to all these expensive, labor-intensive social interventions and research efforts. So researchers from the University of California may have uncovered what can only be described as a cure for aging. Quite literally a fountain of youth, an easily obtained, naturally occurring substance which could halt or even reverse the effects of age-related degeneration. And the best thing of all, there are vast, untapped reserves of it, and they are constantly being replenished. Because the miracle substance is the blood of the young.
I really wish they had included in this study, and maybe they have, grouping of whether the blood was from virgins or not.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, that is the obvious one. So yeah, this paper was published by a team under Saul Villeda and Tony Vice-Corre, or to give them their true names, Professors Vlad Tepes and Elizabeth Bathory. And they demonstrate that exposing elderly mice to the blood of younger animals can reverse the effects of aging on synaptic plasticity, dendrite density, and on cognitive tests of spatial learning, memory, and fear conditioning. And now, this is by no means an isolated study, and the technique they use to transfer the blood has been used by other researchers to show improvements in stem cell function in numerous areas, including the brain, the liver, and the spinal cord. So it's not an isolated thing. This is real, guys. This is happening.
But the one that has really made the news is about cognitive functioning, because secretly, it turns out psychology is more important than stem cells. I don't have, a celebratory music. I guess I could click...
Yay!
Yeah, you could. Now... I don't know about you, but for me, this whole inject the blood of the young to treat the elderly kind of seems like it ought to be being found in some archaic medical journal from a previous century. You can kind of imagine the ancient Romans doing something like this, or maybe the Nazis. Less so researchers from the University of California in 2014. Indeed, the author...
I don't know, were they the University of California at San Diego?
San Francisco, I think.
Okay, well, it's still the UC. The point is, which professor is perhaps strongly associated with the University of California? It's only, damn you, Squire! Like, the evil wow. that seeps out into that institution.
Okay, because there is clearly a systemic problem in the University of California in terms of using a grotesque and unnecessary procedure when a more simple and less harrowing one would be okay. I will come to this later.
To be fair, I do think we have listeners at the University of California. So
okay, yeah, well, sure. Anyway.
There are moles in kind of in the castle of Dracula.
Yeah. So anyway, actually, talking about the, you know, the appropriateness otherwise of this technique, the author, Tony Vice-Corre, is quoted in a news release for this project as saying, "This could have been done 20 years ago. You don't need to know anything about how the brain works. You just give an old mouse young blood and see if the animal's smarter than before. It's just that nobody did it." So, yeah, I suppose you've kind of got a point. I mean, sure, it's not exactly the kind of thing that would fly in a school science competition, but there's probably someone out there with a ready supply of rats, a few hypodermic needles, and a bar full of milk who could have got this whole process going years ago. I mean, it's not like the researchers decided to transfer the blood between the mice using a series of needlessly convoluted and gruesome procedures that push the very boundaries of moral and ethical practice, right?
Wait a minute.
What's that? Well, what is heterochronic parabiosis anyway?
Doesn't sound nice.
No, wait. Hang on. I'll Google it. Heterochronic parabiosis. Oh, thank you, autocomplete. That's good. Now let's have a look. Oh, God. Oh, sweet, merciful Freud, those poor, poor creatures.
I think I saw a picture on, like, a TV show. It looked unsubtle and kind of horrifying.
Yeah, so there's going to be pictures in the show notes for this.
Yes. Trigger warning.
Yeah, trigger warning. So, you see, apparently, when you are draining the vital essence of youth from the blood of the young, you can't simply use a straightforward transfusion, no. Instead, the researchers in this, and apparently in the previous studies that I mentioned, used a process called heterochronic parabiosis, the technical summary for which I shall now read. However, at this point, and I mean this in all seriousness, if you are of a nervous or squeamish disposition, you really should skip the next 30 seconds or so. So, quoting from the article, "Parabiosis surgery followed the previously described procedures. Mirror image incisions at the left and right flanks were made through the skin, and shorter incisions were made through the abdominal wall. The peritoneal openings of the adjacent parabionts were sutured together. Elbow and knee joints for each parabiont were sutured together, and the skin of each mouse was stapled, 9mm autoclip, Clay Adams, thank you for the specificity, to the skin of the adjacent parabiont." So,
why,
yeah,
they cut
open two mice and stapled them together.
This is part of the reason why I never did animal research.
Yeah. So like,
I know that meat is murder, but meat isn't stapling two mice together.
Yeah. So they go on to point out that the mice's recovery was monitored in terms of pair grooming behaviors and stress responses. Stress responses, which I imagine ran along the lines of the mouse equivalent of,
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is like, it's like, it's not the human centipede, but it's not far off.
Not
far enough off enough that the mouse isn't going to really be freaked out.
Yeah. So there were some technical pictures, which I'll put in, not actual pictures, though yeah, I'm sure if you Googled them, you probably could find them.
Yeah.
So anyway, having completed the conjoinment, certainly, and then presumably having sat in a blank-eyed silence for several minutes, feeling the last vestiges of humanity slip away from them, the researchers went on to test the physiological and psychological outcomes of the blood sharing. First, they compared gene expression in a number of key regions between old mice who were paired with young mice and old mice who were paired with more old mice. What they found was that there are an increased number of cells expressing genes relating to the production of a substance called CREB, or cyclic adenosine monophosphate response element binding protein. I used to know that by heart for my exams. I do not anymore. You can see why it is called CREB. So CREB has a well-established role in neuroplasticity and the formation, in particular, of long-term and spatial memories. And it's even, apparently, been applied therapeutically to reduce the symptoms of Alzheimer's. So finding elevated levels of CREB on exposure to youthful blood certainly makes sense for the whole, you know, bathing the blood of the innocents hypothesis. So next, the authors looked at structural changes, and what they found was increased dendritic density in the dentate gyrus in young paired mice compared with aged paired mice. Now, the dentate gyrus is a structure within the hippocampus. Again, it's closely related to episodic memory function and spatial exploration and neural plasticity in adults. And to confirm the kind of functional effects of these changes, they measured long-term potentiation, which is a neurobiological mechanism that is central to memory formation and kind of neuronal learning. They measured this LTP, long-term potentiation, in a slice of hippocampal tissue. Oh yes, obviously all the mice were killed and dissected at the end of the study, you know, standard operating procedure for this kind of work. Although, given the Cronenbergian nightmare existence of these particular mice, that might have, I kind of agree, that was probably the kindest thing to do, given that they'd sewn them together. Anyway, on testing the hippocampal LTP, they found that levels of potentiation were significantly above baseline for the young paired mice compared to the older paired mice. Finally, they looked at cognitive function. Now, this presents a bit of a methodological problem, because presumably it's pretty difficult to run a pair of surgically conjoined mice through like a standard water maze or a radio alarm maze or anything like that. So
slightly wider.
But for this study,
that was like the Thai bombers of mice.
They're not dissimilar to that American fighter plane that I was telling you about earlier.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, apparently it was too much of a methodological problem.
Okay.
So for this study, the researchers just injected 100 cubic millimeters of mouse blood into aged animals 8 times over a period of 3 weeks.
What?
Yeah!
So all of this stuff just was for the genetic stuff? Like,
You see what I mean about the squire issue? This is the equivalent of stabbing cadavers before noticing the MRI machine in the corner.
Yes, it is.
So anyway, having demonstrated the complete pointlessness and needlessness of their gruesome heterochronic parabiosis, they found that they did a fear conditioning task, and aged mice who'd received transfusions of young mouse plasma, they showed accelerated learning of the fear associations, and in a water maze, they showed faster detection and recall of the platform compared to similarly aged mice who had received transfusions from similarly other aged mice.
Yeah.
So all these data, they provide pretty comprehensive evidence for the idea that exposure to young blood reduces or even reverses the degenerative effects of aging. Now, clearly a few major questions remain. Do the effects last beyond exposure? For example, will our grandparents need regular injections of child blood or permanently surgically attached infants in order to maintain their cognitive function? Also, my office mate Felix pointed out that in case of the surgically attached mice, maybe just being stuck to a younger animal kind of induced the epigenetic and structural changes, because we know that environment can have an impact on the expression of, and you know, the function of genes on epigenetic changes.
Yeah.
And maybe just being next to a young mouse had kind of a very extreme and literal version of embodied cognition, you know.
Wow. It's perfectly plausible.
And the, obviously, you know, your control for that would be, rather than actually like plugging in the mice, you just glue them together.
Yeah,
which is less of a funny joke. It's less of a funny joke in the context of what has actually gone on in this study.
The comical idea of attaching one animal to another animal suddenly lost some of its charm.
It's comically extreme. Psychologists gluing mice together? Ha ha, how ridiculous. No, wait. No, that would be a step down in terms of animal welfare, or a step up, I guess. Anyway, I'm kind of loath to give these guys ideas or actually encourage more of this research. But
yeah, it is like the, why don't Al-Qaeda do this?
But they really could do with some more rigorous control groups. And of course, the major question to emerge from this paper, given that the psychological effects of exposure to youthful blood were observed after a short period of plasma injections, is why in the name of ever-loving Freud did they need to go through the whole mouse centipede nonsense in the first place?
Yep.
Now, putting all of the horribleness to one side, the results of the study are genuinely kind of fascinating. And what I particularly like about how the way it's written is how the authors never explicitly say that their results should be replicated in human subjects. They just really heavily imply it. For instance, in the abstract, the first sentence reads, as human lifespan increases, a greater fraction of the population is suffering from age-related cognitive impairments, making it important to elucidate a means to combat the effects of aging. The very next sentence then dives right in with, here we report that exposure of an aged animal, not a mouse, note, an animal, because you know humans are animals, aren't they? They fail to add in parentheses. The exposure of an aged animal to young blood can counteract and reverse pre-existing effects of brain aging at the molecular, structural, functional, and cognitive level. I feel like this whole paper should have a massive red stamp on it that reads hashtag just saying. So my final question to the authors, therefore, is this. If, or more likely, when you begin your inevitable human trials and thus kickstart our latest version of the neuroscientifically induced apocalypse, assuming that the cocaine monkeys, the psychotic love robots, or the scrub jays don't beat you to it, when you do, I want you to make absolutely sure that somewhere along the line you check, just check, whether blood transfusions work across species. Because, you see, I am terrified to my very core by the idea of a future in which a generation of pensioner immortals rule over mankind, their vital energies supplied by a dystopian nightmare of child farms. But, you know, I think I could maybe just about manage to live in a world where each morning we staple a couple of fresh mice to Granny so she can find her way to the shops.
To be honest, yeah, the thing I'm taking away from this study is I need to invest in a shotgun. But, or, alternatively, the other thing I'm taking away is, by the time they've got this working, we'll be those old people, Ben.
Yay! We will benefit from the travesties of the generation before us.
Yep, like rocket technology.
So, yeah, that was an interesting, harrowing, and fascinating study to read.
Yeah.
Well done, guys.
Hey, why don't we do... Would you like to hear about something really, really freaky that you could actually do to yourself at home?
I mean, haven't we just?
More easily. So earlier on the day I did this prep, I was explaining to my hairdresser about mirror agnosia, because what do you do at the salon? I do think my hairdresser is brilliant. She has like a savant-like memory for personal details, in which in my cases she knows that I work at a hospital and that I like real coffee, which only she of the salon staff cares about. So I also loosely explained the difference between episodic and semantic memory, as she said she struggles to remember details of her own life. But the reason I was mentioning mirrors was because I knew there was a study about mirrors in this week's episode, and also because I was sitting in front of a huge mirror. And it was either that or stare at myself. I mean, I did do a lot of my staring, you know, a lot of staring at myself too. I'm still me, don't worry. So, Giovanni Caputo wrote in the journal Perception, for what appears to be a regular feature, last but not least, which shows a great deal of whimsy for what is by definition the most boring journal in the world ever. I mean, have I mentioned I hate Perception? The opening sentence is one of those sciencey sentences that confuses normal people. I describe a visual illusion which occurs when an observer sees his or her image reflected in a mirror in a dimly lit room. No, you don't. You're going to, maybe, but you haven't in that sentence described the visual illusion. Scientists are weird with their tenses. I mean, I guess it's all that fear research. Thank you. So, they got a 25-watt lamp.
A 25 what?
This was one of my physics teacher's favourite jokes. Unit for power is what?
We've done this. We've been over this many times before, and it still amuses me.
good for you. The other one that my physics teachers, that like classic physics teacher jokes, was this Mark scheme's done really well, which I think is amazing, but no one else finds funny. Okay, so yeah, they got the 25-watt lamp, they put it on the floor, and they got a 0.5 meter by 0.5 meter mirror, and they had the participants stand about 0.4 meters from it. So the lighting in this scenario meant that the participants could see their faces detailed, but the colours were reduced. Romantic. But even with a bit more light, after about a minute, the strange face illusion emerged. Ooh. So Caputo had 50 naive participants, naive in the sense that they didn't know anything about the illusion, not overall naive. I mean, they didn't check, but we can assume that some of them weren't. So they had them look at the mirror in this setup for 10 minutes and then write down what they saw. 66% of them saw their own faces, but hugely deformed. 18% saw a version of their parents' face. Of that 18%, 8% of the total referred to living parents, and 10% of the total referred to a dead parent. 28% saw an unknown person, 28% saw an archetypal face, 18% saw an animal face, and 48% saw monstrous or fantastical beings' faces. I mean, that's a pretty striking illusion for something so simple. Now, perception scientists already know about the Troxler fading, which really does sound like a new Doctor Who thing, you know, like... Oh, yeah. You know, the ruins of Trenzalore, and it's like the Troxler fading. I'll link the Wikipedia so you can experience this particular illusion for yourself. Essentially, like, it's when the outlines of something, when you're fixated on the middle, start to fade, and there's a nice GIF that explains it on the Wikipedia page. That does happen with faces if you stare at the middle of them enough, but this isn't what's happening. Things are appearing, not disappearing. So there's other weird visual illusions where weird stuff appears out of nowhere. And I don't just mean when you pull a bunch of flowers from your sleeve. So one was found by Simus in the year 2000. If you place photos in the peripheral vision, and really, who doesn't, then the things you'll see include variations of the facial traits and expressions or appearances of new ones like teeth or a beard, as well as completely new faces, 3D distortions, rotations, upside down faces, the subject's own face, sometimes younger or older. Yeah, that's right. You from the future in a Polaroid picture seen out of the corner of your eye. My goodness, it's spooky. So they believe whatever effect is happening is amplified when you are looking head on and centrally fixated. And the peripheral vision thing, you can actually achieve it in a mirror as well by looking at the mirror in three-quarter profile. But they believe in the central fixation, the effects are amplified from the merely intriguing to often unsettling. Yeah, basically a coin toss chance of seeing a monstrous being instead of your own face. I'd call that Freuding unsettling. So, what do they think is happening to cause this? Well, maybe if you look at facial features for long enough in low light, this might screw up the gestalt processing. Now, gestalt, which is German for the whole or the collective, is the fact that we perceive certain things more clearly as their total than as the sum of their parts. Words rather than letters, shapes rather than lines, faces rather than the body parts. So if the gestalt uncouples, perhaps the face will become distorting. And then the higher level processing of faces tries and gets its head around it, and thus we end up with clear faces after that, but not the right faces. However, as they point out, although not quite the same way that I'm going to point out, no model of face processing ever accounted for the fusiform dragon area. Yet. On top of this, every single one of the participants experienced some sense of dissociation. That seeing something other, something unfamiliar, staring back at them, it caused a dent in their sense of self and then provoked strong emotions, though these were both positive or negative based on what they saw the apparition doing. I think what we're learning here is what we've long suspected, that mirrors are officially witchcraft. So the get out of Caputo is that viewing a face in a mirror is actually more complicated than looking at a photo, because mirror viewing involves an integration of visual, motor and proprioception systems. As well as this, it triggers areas involved in self-identity, which emerge far later in development, apparently around 2 to 3 years. And clearly this higher level bit is being impaired by the illusion as well, on the basis of the participant's experience. I think what we really need to do is repeat this experiment with young children and have a good child clinical psychologist.
Yeah.
Caputo doesn't really have an answer, but obviously the internet has picked up the pop culture aspects of the study, describing it as the science behind Bloody Mary or Candyman or Beetlejuice. But it is really creepy, perhaps more so, because it's not really understood. It's some kind of almost shamanic, tapping some weird part of our imagination to channel the past, the future, and the unreal. So, Psychomedia top tip, try it. A low lamplight, a big mirror, and go and turn yourself into the monster you secretly are inside. And don't blame us if you freak the Freud out.
Tying that back to what we were talking about before in the What Move section of video games and Second World War, I've been watching someone do a playthrough of the new Wolfenstein game.
Oh, yes.
Which I think I'm probably going to pick up because it looks actually genuinely awesome, like a really interesting story and stuff. And one of the really nice touches that they do, it's kind of this alternate history where the Nazis won the war and it's set in the 1960s and kind of the Third Reich has taken over the world. And you're sort of exploring. And one of the really neat things that they do is that in all the bathrooms, the mirrors have been removed from the walls.
Right.
And you can see the outline of where the mirror was, but there isn't a mirror there. And I just thought that's such a nice touch of like, mirrors are highly unpopular in Nazi Germany because they can't bear to look at themselves in the eyes kind of thing.
Okay, yeah, interesting.
So that was very cool. Anyway.
For that sort of video game, which isn't associated with depth.
Exactly.
Previous installments, anyway.
Anyway, let's round this up with some fairly straightforward horror. After all this existential and body horror weirdness, we've sort of covered, you know, Cronenbergian body horror. We've done like existential psychological horror with your mirrors. What was the first one?
Kind of jump scares.
We've done jump scares, exactly.
And stuff like that.
Now we're going to round it out with standard like monster horror and specifically arachnophobia. So you may recall many episodes ago, I talked about one of my favorite studies in the whole of psychology, in which participants were placed in an fMRI scanner and asked to push a button to bring a live corn snake closer and closer to them.
Now, as if any of us could forget.
Now, clearly, this would have been an ideal study to discuss this week, but unfortunately, we've already done it, and I'm not quite sure we've yet reached the point of such desperation that we need to rehash old material, at least not intentionally.
I was going to say, parachute sweat.
Yeah, but that's not intentional. I just have an appalling memory. But it did get me wondering if there were any other studies in which people had been scanned in close proximity to scary animals. And what do you know? Once again, neuroscience doesn't disappoint. So this study by Dean Mobbs and colleagues at Cambridge, actually, is entitled Neural Activity Associated with Monitoring the Oscillating Threat Value of a Tarantula. Or as I have subtitled it, Spiderfoot does whatever a spiderfoot... Oh my God, there's a spider on my foot! Get it off! Ah!
Okay, when you said spider feet originally as how you summarised this, I assumed it was the feet of spiders, not spiders on your feet.
No, it is the latter. What I find disappointing is that, given that the title is Neural Activity Associated with Monitoring the Oscillating Threat Value of a Tarantula, I was very sad to discover that they didn't tie a tarantula to a piece of string and wave it back and forth in front of someone's face.
I think an oscillating tarantula would be scarier than a regular tarantula.
Well,
I wasn't
let's
thinking
find out.
Yeah, that's true.
What we'll find from this study, a little preview, is that it would be, on average, exactly as frightening as a tarantula positioned at the midpoint of the swing of the oscillation.
That's kind of like a weird version of physics. It's like nightmare physics.
For UC... In this study, the authors wish to investigate how the brain's fear processing mechanisms respond to approaching or retreating threats. So you may remember in the previous study with the snake, they found that actively choosing to move the snake closer elicited activity in prefrontal brain areas associated with the suppression of instinctive fear responses. On the other hand, moving the snake away produced more traditional kind of amygdala activation associated with the flight response, or as it's more technically known, the oh sweet Jesus, get it away from me reflex. So in today's study, however, the authors wanted to find out how this kind of fear or bravery activity varied with proximity of the threatening stimulus. But not just proximity, also like the motion, the velocity of the threat relative to the subject. For example, in general, you would expect similar levels of fear-related activity for two equivalent threats that are equal distances away. But if one of those threats is moving towards you and the other one is moving away, you would probably expect the one moving towards you to be more threatening, even though they're technically the same distance at the time of measurement.
Yep.
So the setup for this was kind of interesting. They placed participants in an fMRI scanner and then enclosed one of their feet in a transparent plastic box, which they refer to horrifyingly as the imminence box.
Yep, pretty bad.
So this box had like, it was like a long rectangular box with a series of compartments, with each compartment, you know, closer and closer to the compartment containing the participant's foot. Barefoot, by the way. So the participants couldn't actually see their feet in the box from inside the scanner, but they were watching a video screen, which ostensibly showed a live video feed of the box. And as the participants watched, they saw a live Brazilian salmon pink tarantula being placed into various compartments in the box. Now, calling it a Brazilian salmon pink tarantula maybe somewhat diminishes the threat value, I feel. It kind of gives an image of a suave Latino tarantula wearing a white fedora, loose pink shirt and chinos, lounging in a cocktail bar with a beige jacket draped elegantly over one of its eight shoulders. Therefore, if you were any...
I'm just like impressed with the thought that's gone into the idea that a tarantula has eight shoulders. I want to commend you for that.
Thank you. So, but, you know, if you feel that the name of the salmon pink tarantula diminishes its threat value, if you're in any doubt, either Google it or just head to the show notes because there will be a picture. And then imagine that guy less than 10 centimeters away from your bare foot. And then when you finish twitching and squirming, come back and tell me that that wouldn't be scary.
Yeah, I'm not even like that, like, phobic of spiders. Scorpions are like my real nemesis, but... it does make me feel uncomfortable just picturing the study.
I did not enjoy reading this study, and I certainly didn't enjoy Googling Brazilian salmon pink tarantula. But I enjoyed it more than I enjoyed Google image searching heterochronic parabiosis. Wouldn't recommend that one. Only a couple of pictures of it. Just don't bother. So, anyway... They analysed the scans of these participants' brains, and they found that they obviously found activity in like the standard fear network, as they expected. They also found a midbrain area called the periaqueductal grey, or the PAG, showed increased activity as the tarantula got closer, and its activity also correlated with the participants' trait arachnophobia scores. So this is kind of like the personal imminence of the threat. Conversely, they found that the medial prefrontal cortex showed increased activity as the tarantula got further away, suggesting that it might be related to a kind of passive fear reaction, like maybe a freezing response, like the brain is activating its flight response, but the prefrontal cortex knows that the threat is still far away, so it's probably best to just stay still and hope it goes away rather than running.
Yeah, interesting.
Finally, they found a whole bunch of different areas which showed selective activation for when the tarantula was approaching the participant, regardless of how far away it actually was. So, just like, excuse me, just like with the snake study, it's a fairly horrifying and ridiculous premise, and it's reduced down nicely to a set of extremely dry neuroimaging data, from which we may conclude that, yes, we do get more scared when scary things are close to us, and yes, we can tell the difference between threats that are approaching versus those that are retreating. I'm sure the traumatized participants from this study will be pleased to hear that their newly acquired phobias are totally worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, to conclude...
in our multi-award-winning conclusion section...
Ways you can scare people are noises that they can't quite figure out where they're coming from, Brazilian salmon pink tarantulas.
Staring at a mirror in a dimly lit room.
Yes, and...
Googling heterochronic parabiosis.
Yep, there we go.
Would also, you know, in conclusion, if you have a younger sibling or someone you know who has the same blood type as you and a staple gun, and you want to try staving off the inevitable march of aging and human frailty, then please do write in and tell us how it went. You can contact the show in a variety of ways. You can email us at psychomediapodcast@gmail.com.
You can go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/psychomedia.
You can tweet at us at Team Psychomedia or at Tetrarchangel for Tim's specific feedback.
And finally, there is the most important one of all, which is psychomedia.wordpress.com. See the images, bleach your brain, come back.
There are numerous... even the technical drawings from that spider study are kind of... make me cringe a bit. There's just a picture of a bare foot and then a series of ever closer tarantulas. There can be a nice big picture of a Brazilian pink.
I was gonna say, it's a good album name, I think. A series of ever closer tarantulas.
Yeah. Yeah, then just one technical drawing of heterochronic parabiosis, which I think is probably all that's required.
Yep.
Cool.
Yes, we've resynchronized. I didn't refer to that at the start of the show. Should mean that we get more consistency. In reality, it means we'll have probably about the same amount.
Yes, we have. We've climbed to the top of a very tall building where there was an eagle sitting, chased the eagle away, and then perched on the edge of the building while the camera pans around us and the sound goes, ah!
What?
Assassin's Creed, man.
Okay.
When you climb tall buildings, you press the and it goes synchronization complete.
Okay. I was not picturing that in the during the Crusades. I was confused. I was picturing like an office building and you in a suit. Assassin's Creed has come out. It's called Watch Dogs. But until next fortnight, and then hopefully progressively every fortnight, we'll see you next time.
Bye for now.
Yes.
Sweet dreams, kiddies.
I was working in the lab late one night when my subject gave me a ferocious bite. I cried in alarm and away he raced, but for human blood he developed a taste.
He was a mouse.
He was a monster
mouse.
And we called him Klaus.
He was a mouse.
He drank blood like a mouse.
He was a
monster mouse. Through my lab he ran with supernatural speed, and on innocent victims began to feed. When I caught up, I couldn't believe my eyes, for in each drop of blood, Klaus was growing in size.
He was a mouse.
He was a monster
mouse.
And we called him Klaus.
He was a mouse.
He was the size of a house.
He was a mouse.
He was a monster mouse. The people were all fleeing or dead. He turned to me, eyes blazing red. I reached in my lunchbox and to him I said, "Would you like to try Ribena instead?" The ground shook as above me he loomed, and I thought to myself, "You're surely doomed." Then he sniffed at my gift, took a tentative drink, and at once his eyes turned from red to pink.
He was a mouse.
He was a monster
mouse.
And we called him Klaus.
He was a mouse.
We fed him blackcurrant
jousts.
He was a monster mouse. Now everything's cool. Klaus is very well trained. So long as his supply of Ribena's maintained, it all turned out better than I expected. And I've never once since had a paper rejected.
He is a mouse.
He is a monster
mouse.
And we call him Klaus.
He is a mouse.
He is the size of a house.
He is a mouse.
He is a monster mouse.